Support for programming comes from the Burkholder Project, celebrating 25 years of artist works. Artists in residence with Open Door Studios at 719 P Street in Lincoln. BurkholderProject.com. Good morning and welcome to Friday Live here on NET Radio, live from the mill in Lincoln's Haymarket. I'm Genevieve Randall. Today's program will feature two unique art projects in Decatur and Lyons, Nebraska, as well as a project involving an RV and 830 miles of conversations across the state. We'll also meet composer Daniel Baldwin, artist Sue Perez from North Platte, and talk with a member of the cast of Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. We'll start the show this morning with the filmmaker who has worked with PBS on programming for Nova, Frontline, History Detectives, and much more. She was nominated for a Grammy in 2003 for her independent production, Welcome to the Club, The Women of Rockabilly. Beth Harrington is the director of a new music documentary, The Winding Stream, about the Carter and Cash families and their influence on American roots music. Beth Harrington, it's great to have you here on Friday Live.
Thanks for having me, Genevieve.
Absolutely. You are actually a musician yourself.
I am.
What kind of musical activities have you participated
in? That's a good way to phrase it. Contrary to the film that we're going to be talking about, I'm actually more of a rock and roll person. So for many, many years, I was in rock and roll bands, and frankly, I still am today. I'm in a rock and roll band in Portland, Oregon. Called Spiracles. Yay, Spiracles. But I was in a band called the Modern Lovers in the 1980s, and that was, it's sort of considered a proto-punk band. So that's kind of my background, is that kind of rock and roll.
So then what brought you to filmmaking?
Well, I was always making films, too. The Modern Lovers part of it was a weird detour along my way to making films. But I was actually making films at the time anyway. But when someone offers you a chance to tour with a rock and roll band, you don't say no. You do
it. Sure.
So that's how... But I've been making films for a long time. I started not long after I got out of college and been working on other people's projects and then my own.
So throughout your newest film, The Winding Stream, there are clips of an interview with Johnny Cash. Mm-hmm. When was that interview done?
It was done 3 weeks before he passed away in 2003.
I wondered about that. It's just, he's obviously so moved and emotional when he's telling stories of both, you know, his own family and the Carter family, of course. Right in the beginning of the film, and I can't remember who says it, forgive me, but she compares the importance of the Carter family to the Beatles in that their music influenced everything that came after.
That's right.
What would some examples be of that influence?
Well, that was Roseanne Cash who mentioned it, and I think the obvious examples are things like Keep on the Sunny Side and Will the Circle Be Unbroken and, you know, It Takes a Worried Man to Sing a Worried Song, and those kinds of seminal folk songs have been in our culture for so long that, you know, people know them without really thinking about them, and a lot of people don't even know who to attribute them to. So that's kind of the bedrock of what they're about.
I was going to say, I think when I hear those, I don't think about the Carter family and make the connection. So was that something that occurred to you at some point? Was there a moment when you thought, huh, these people are connected to this, I need to make a film about it?
Yeah, I mean, what happened was I had been working on the other film you mentioned, Welcome to the Club, The Women of Rockabilly, and that... you know, I'm interested in music in general. I love all kinds of music. I play rock and roll, but I'm interested in all kinds of music. So this took me to a place where I realized, you know, I love knowing what the antecedents are of the music that I love. And so I was pushing further and further back. I kind of looked at rhythm and blues for a long time, and then I moved back into, you know, areas that I hadn't explored. And country was certainly one of them, and rockabilly was a subset of that. And while I was working on that film, I realized that these women who were seminal rock and roll people in their own right, peers of Elvis Presley's, they grew up listening to people like the Carters. And I knew of the Carters, and I knew June Carter Cash, and of course I knew Johnny Cash. But I thought, you know, a lot of people don't really understand the connections there, and I didn't fully understand them until I started really doing research, and I realized this is like the fundamental family in country music. They recorded in 1927, And that same week that they recorded for the first time, Jimmy Rogers also was part of those sessions. And people call that the Big Bang of country music now. That's the origin story of all country music, presumably. I mean, you know, you could argue that. So, you know, that kind of, those kind of connections were whirling around in my head when I started thinking about making the film.
We could probably talk about this film for a long time, because I found it very interesting. But one aspect of the film that I find sort of fascinating is border radio. Mm-hmm. If you could maybe explain briefly for listeners what it is and talk about how it changed things for the Carters.
Yeah, so border radio got started by a man named Dr. John Brinkley, who was in Kansas, not all that far from where we are, and he was kind of a maverick broadcaster in Kansas, got run out of town on a rail because he was one of these early medical people before there was a really established AMA as we know it today. And he went to the Mexican border to get out of reach of the federal, what was then the Federal Radio Commission, what we would call the FCC now, so he could broadcast at any wattage that he wanted. So he was broadcasting at like a million watts from the Mexican border. So as a result, he signed up the Carters, and their music was heard all over the world.
Incredible.
Because of Dr. Brinkley.
It's a lot of wattage. I enjoyed the depiction of that in the film,
Northern
for
Lights.
Sure. Yeah, like the Northern Lights from the station. That's good. I've been talking with filmmaker Beth Harrington. She'll be available tonight for a Q&A following the 7:30 p.m. showing of her film, The Winding Stream, a documentary about the family at the heart of American roots music, the Carters and the Cashes. It's a pleasure having you here this
Thank
morning.
Thank you so much. It was really fun.
And again, Winding Stream opens tonight at the Ross in Lincoln and runs through Thursday, November 5th. Still to come this morning, we'll meet composer Daniel Baldwin and one of the cast members of A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. That's just ahead here on Friday Live. The news and music that inspires Nebraska. You're listening to NET Radio and netnebraska.org, celebrating 25 years of service. Artist Sue Perez will be featured in an exhibit in North Platte this month at the North Platte Art and Gift. The exhibit is called The Eclectic Art of Sue Perez and runs November 3rd through the 28th. Her work will also be part of the annual Kaleidoscope event at the Museum of Nebraska Art in Kearney, featuring over 30 artists from around the Midwest. That's on November 7th and 8th. Many of her pieces are very detailed and full of color, using a technique called Zentangle. She joins me now to tell us a bit more about that. Sue, thanks for taking some time to talk with me.
This is great. I love visiting about my art and what I'm doing.
So to describe one of your pieces, I'm looking here at a photo on the North Platte Art and Gift website of what is very clearly an eye. In the iris, we can see orange and red and yellow. And all around the eye are these amazing geometric patterns and designs in bright, bold colors. How did you start working on pieces like this one?
Well, I've been doing these abstract design pieces for probably 8 years now. They started a lot more simple, but they kind of start themselves. I typically start with the realistic part of my drawing, like the eye in that piece you're looking at. And then as I go, it kind of dictates the direction I will go, whether I, you know, what colors I use, what designs work well with that. That sounds silly to most people, but it's kind of a meditative state that you get into, a zen, you might say, when you're drawing. And it dictates the direction of the drawing. It just kind of draws itself sometimes.
So that's sort of the zen part of Zentangle. How did you first learn about that technique to make art?
I just kind of started doing it. Actually, when I was in seventh grade, way back in the 60s, and all the pop art was, I painted my bicycle similar to what I'm doing now, with eyes and designs and lots of color. And it's kind of a throwback to that first piece I did way back when, before I was an artist, before art was important to me. And I've always doodled. It's kind of a structured doodling. So it's kind of been with me most of my life. And I've just kind of focused on it recently and started using it. And it's something that everybody can relate to, and everybody who looks at it sees something different.
I'm seeing another one of what's clearly a wolf face with some patterns then across the face. And there's so many little lines in there. How long does it take you to do a piece?
They're all different times. I would say I might have anywhere between maybe 20 and 40 hours per picture, depending upon the size and how intricate I make it. There's really no set time. A lot of times I'm drawing in the middle of the night. I lose track of time. I'll start drawing sometimes at, you know, 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and I'll stand up and wonder why I'm so sore, and I'll look, and it'll be 5 in the morning. I just today got my first coloring book. I've been working on coloring books with the adult coloring book craze, and today I got my first shipment of adult coloring books with my Zentangle animal designs in it. And I think that's kind of fun for people to take my designs and add their own color.
Not all of your work uses that Zentangle method. I see a depiction here in some grays and yellows of a woman looking out a window next to a flower arrangement. What other kinds of methods do you use for your work?
A lot of things are memories. Even my Zentangle designs are memories. Animals have been a big part of my life, so I do a lot of animals. I've done a lot of traveling, so things I've seen, things I've experienced. The woman you're referring to is kind of a picture of my grandmother. Not exactly, but a memory of sitting on the floor at my grandmother's house and looking up and seeing her look out the window through her yellowed, lacy curtains. So a lot of things start from a little memory hidden back in my mind.
What's some of the feedback that you've gotten from other people about your work?
I do such a wide range of items that a lot of people will walk past one picture I've done and then stop dead in their tracks at the next, because it does have a personal feel to them, like maybe they've had that same memory of grandmother, or maybe they've visited that same area in Alaska that I've drawn. Different pieces will strike people differently. I did a painting years ago that, to me, was hilarious. It was a wine bottle with a jester on it, and I was 50 when I did it, so I was thinking about aging, and so I had a picture of my a wrinkle cream and my estrogen pills, and I have always had an issue with time, so if the clock had lots of hands on it and the numbers went backwards, there was a cracked mirror. So to me, it was a statement of aging. But I was at a show, and I had these young boys leaning down and just studying it intently. They saw something different in it. They thought it was deep and dark. They said, this is about drugs and alcohol and broken lives. It just struck me how different people find something completely different in what I do.
Artwork by Sue Perez will be included in the annual Kaleidoscope event at the Museum of Nebraska Art in Kearney. That's November 7th and 8th. And an exhibit of her work will be on display at North Platte Art and Gift Gallery November 3rd through the 28th. Sue, it's been great talking with you about your work.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And you can link to more information about the North Platte exhibit on the Friday Live page of our website, netnebraska.org/radio. I'm Genevieve Randall. Listening to Friday Live here on NET Radio, broadcasting from the Mill in downtown Lincoln. Stay with us to learn about Stuart Chittenden's trip across Nebraska in an RV and his appearances in Hastings and Scotts Bluff to share stories of Nebraska. Next here on Friday Live, the Nebraska Chamber Players have two performances this weekend, both tonight at 8 and Sunday at 3 at the NET Studios in Lincoln with harpist Kathleen Wychulis. Their program will feature music by Jean-Michel Demaz, Claude Debussy, André Jolivet, William Alwyn, and Daniel Baldwin. Flutist Becky van de Bogart and violist Clark Potter join me now, along with that last composer I mentioned, Daniel Baldwin. It's great to have you all here.
Good morning.
Thank you, Genevieve.
Good morning. So let's meet our guest composer first here. You studied actually in part with Tyler White at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. What are some other influences on your music?
Oh, I love 20th century composition. Aaron Copland is a big influence, and of course, with the lyrical writing, Vaughan Williams. A lot of my music really tends toward the lyrical, and some teachers, Eric Uwazin and Eric Richards from here, and of course, Tyler White.
I noticed that Eric Uwazin had even a quote on your website that was very nice, very complimentary.
Oh, he's a sweet, sweet man.
Now, the piece that Nebraska Chamber Players will perform tonight and Sunday of yours is titled In the Shining of the Stars. Can you connect the title to the music for us?
Oh, well, not really.
I might be able to do a little bit of
that.
Yeah?
Sure.
The piece, it's beautiful and spacious, and I think that one of the things, it's very contemplative and peaceful, and so it's easy to wonder sometimes how we need to treat this piece, but then we just decided, you know, it's about space, and it's beautiful.
Very organic.
Yeah, Becky was saying last night the three layers. You have a contrabassoon, for heaven's sake.
Which is subterranean.
Subterranean, right. And then the viola, which is earthy.
Earthy. And then, of course, the harp, which is the ultimate celestial instrument. So it's this, it's a very wide range of very organic interplay, I think, between the three instruments. It's brilliant combo.
I am hoping you had spaciousness in mind, Daniel, when you composed this piece.
Absolutely. That's why the contrabassoon is in there. Yeah. Lots of space in the bottom.
He was lost in the oil fields in Oklahoma when he wrote it, and that's a pretty spacious place.
So what is the story behind the writing of the piece then?
Well, one of my best friends is Matthew Morris. He's the bassoon teacher at the University of Ohio. And he is probably one of the 5 or 10 best contrabassoon players in the world, and no one knows, unfortunately. He does go out and play at conferences and things like that. I'm hoping with this is going to be on a recording project, and Matt is one of the featured contrabassoon artists on the CD. So I'm really hoping that people will latch on to the contrabassoon a little bit more and realize that it can play more than just very low notes.
Well, and luckily we had a bassoonist who loves playing contrabassoon. Joyce Besch does it in both Omaha and in Lincoln, and not very often you actually have a contrabassoon player in your chamber music ensemble. Just shows you how deep we are.
Matt is doing what's called Contrabassoon and Chamber Music Project. And he has a very vivid imagination for combining instruments, and he's given me several fun challenges, including this one and then another piece for contrabassoon, violin, marimba, and French horn.
Ooh.
That was a number of years ago. And
marimba.
I know. I can't wait to. Yeah. That one.
Some fun challenges for each of these groups. Like, for example, even just the contrabassoon, viola, and harp, the intensely different way that each instrument is articulated was a challenge in writing for it.
So I'm curious about the connection then for the first time between the music, your music, Daniel, and the chamber ensemble. How did you first become connected?
I suppose it's me, the violist, because I played on the recording that was made of this piece and looking for ways to perform it again.
Didn't Katie play too?
And Katie, the harpist, yeah. Right. So between the two of us, we're a part of the recording and looking to perform the piece live.
And we were just talking a second ago, Clark, about one of your other hats as director of the Lincoln Youth Symphony.
Yes. The Youth Symphony premiered a piece called Pantheon of Daniel's last season, and was a tremendous success and a great experience for the students and for me. So yes, and Daniel and I have collaborated in classrooms and all kinds of things at the university.
So I want to talk just a little bit about the rest of the program as well.
Is there anything else on the program? I forgot.
Yeah, right? When I first started reading down the names, I thought, wow, it's going to be an all-French, you know, concert. But no, then I got to William Alwyn and Daniel Baldwin. So tell me about programming this concert.
Oh, I think the three of the pieces are pretty standard harp repertoire, although the Damas is not done very often, and it was not easy even to find a recording for us to listen to of that work. He has, I think he died in 2013, or his anniversary is 2013, I believe, and so there, that can't be right, we're in 15. Anyway, there's an anniversary that's coming up for Damas, and I think there will be many of his works that will be brought to the forefront that have been buried for quite a while. There's a famous flute work that is done quite a bit, but this trio is not performed very often, and it's quaint, it's nice. It's a very easy Damas, great harp part. Originally written for bassoon, but we're putting it on cello this time. And the same with the Jolivet, is actually originally for flute, harp, and bassoon, but Tracy's playing it. So it's kind of an either-or thing, but they were both originally written for bassoon.
So, Daniel, I'd like to know one more thing from you. As a composer, from your perspective as a composer, how it is having different ensembles play these works that you've worked on, people don't realize probably how long it even takes to write pieces sometimes of varying lengths. You put a lot into it personally, so how is it for you hearing them performed?
It's a wonderful adventure. It takes sometimes as little as 2 or 3 days to write a piece, and sometimes as long as 4 and 5 years or longer to write a piece. Like Vaughan Williams wrote an opera that took him 40 years of his life or so, and he even wrote a symphony. It took the material from it and made it into a symphony right in the middle because he never thought he would finish it. It is a wonderful adventure because it's always a collaboration. You write it and you envision it in one way, and then the performers take it, and then they have their own take on it. And each one of those takes is different. Each one of those interpretations is different, and it's always wonderful.
It must be a little like growing a child, right?
Exactly. And then that child is raised by different families, and you get to see what that looks like.
Exactly.
That's a neat experiment. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I've been talking this morning with Becky Vanda Bogart. She's the flutist with Nebraska Chamber Players. Clark Potter is the violist with that ensemble. And Daniel Baldwin is a composer whose music will be performed by the Nebraska Chamber Players tonight at 8 in the NET studios and again at 3 on Sunday. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Stay right here. I'll have highlights from our arts calendar, and we'll meet a man who set out across Nebraska in an RV to collect unique stories of our state and to have conversations. That's ahead here on Friday Live on NET Radio.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They're all together ooky. The Addams Family. Their house is a museum. When people come to see them, they really are a scream. The Addams Family.
Neat. Sweet. Petite.
So get a witch's shawl on, a broomstick you can crawl on. We're gonna pay a call on the Addams Family.
A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder opened in November of 2013 and has gotten rave reviews ever since. Book and lyrics by Robert L. Friedman and music and lyrics by Stephen Lutback. The show opened last night at the Leeds Center for Performing Arts in Lincoln and will run there through Sunday as part of its first national tour. Actor Danny Marcus is in the production and joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Since this is the first national tour and a new musical, give us a short version of how the story goes or how the plot is laid out and how it starts.
Okay, so in the beginning of the show, we meet Monty Navarro. He's a charming, somewhat innocent young man who unfortunately doesn't have a penny to his name. But he discovers that he is in the line of succession to inherit a huge fortune and the title of Earl of Highhurst. The only problem is that there are 8 other people of the Dicewith family who stand in line before him. So Monty does, you know, what any of us would do. He kills them.
Of course.
Of course.
I love it. How did you get involved with the tour of Gentleman's Guide?
Oh, I saw the show on Broadway and fell head over heels with it. So did everything I could to get in for an audition. And I did. I got in and got a call back. And believe it or not, I didn't hear anything for a couple of weeks. And in that couple of weeks, I thought, oh, I didn't get it. And I was called in for jury duty.
Oh.
And I was picked for trial. And wouldn't you know that in the middle of the trial, I got a call from my agent saying, they want to see you again for a final callback. And I knew that the judge wasn't going to let me out of trial. And all my friends are saying, call in sick, you gotta go to this audition. And I was like, I can't call in sick to trial. So I went in and I told them, I just was honest and I said, I have pretty much the audition of my lifetime that I can't miss. And the officer of the court, Officer Steve, gun-toting Steve, was a musical theater actor.
No way.
He was like funny. On the tour of Sunday in the Park with George. And so I think I cried a little. And he pled my case to the judge. The judge let me out of the trial. Let me off the case with a break a leg. I went to the audition, the final callback, the next day, and I got it.
That's got to be a unique situation that only happens, well, probably almost, maybe that's the only time.
Never happened to me before.
Right? I think for some people who have never done theater, it's really different watching the show as opposed to being in it. It's just a different perspective. And obviously, you've gotten to watch the show. Can you describe what it looks like on stage, what kind of things we see?
Oh, my gosh. It is such a highly detailed production. I think that's my favorite thing about it. From top to bottom, the set, the costumes, the lighting, every gesture, every piece of choreography, if you sit up close, every eyebrow raise. I mean, it's just really, you could see the show 10 times and not see everything. There's so many things to see. It's bright and colorful in moments, and it's sort of dark and gothic in other moments. There are some of the most beautiful costumes I've ever seen in my life. And by the way, if you don't have Halloween plans, see the show on Halloween.
There you go.
Our colors are orange and black, for crying out loud.
Perfect. I did notice, too, there's also a fun video you can watch online about some of the quick changes that have to happen.
Yes. So one thing I didn't say about the show is that the Dicewith family, all 8 of them, are played by one actor, the amazing John Rapson. What a genius he is. And the quick changes from one Dicewith family member to the next they're neck breaking. I mean, they're insane. They're less than 20 seconds, and he's doing full top to bottom makeup, hair, clothing. I don't want to go into too many details because what each Dicewith looks like is pretty great surprise.
But it's fascinating, I think, to watch the video because it's not like he has to do this himself. There's kind of reminds me of when the race cars pull off to the side.
Yes.
And there's a team to change the tires.
John has a dresser named Nadine who travels with us. And they're like connected at the hip. Where he goes, she goes. And she is a very integral part of this production, as are our local dressers who help as well. And they're amazingly gorgeous pieces of choreography in and of themselves.
And what's your part of the show?
So I am what is known as a swing, which means that I understudy 4 out of the 6 ladies in the show. But, you know, this cool thing about this show is that a lot of the ladies play multiple characters. And so I think I actually understudy about 32 characters.
Wow. How do you do that? How can you possibly juggle all of that?
I don't know. I'll let you know when I go on for the first time. We'll see how it goes.
What do you think the best reason is to see the show? What do you tell your friends when you convince them to see the show?
I think that there is something for everyone in this show. And I noticed that one of the greatest things about being a swing is that I get to watch the show over and over again. There's a lot of different kinds of humor. There's a real mischievous sense of humor that runs through it. There's a flat-out hilarity. People are literally falling over themselves laughing. There's kind of a quirky darkness to it. There's romance. There's pretty princess dresses. There's a real cleverness. Some of the most amazing lyrics I've ever heard in my life. If you're into rhymes, come see the show. If you're into pink dresses, come see the show. It's funny. It's sexy. It's everything. That's what I tell people. I say, just come.
Yeah.
Just if you want to have a good time, this is it.
Danny Marcus is part of the cast of A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, now on its first national tour. And the cast had its first performance last night and will perform at the Lead Center for Performing Arts again tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday. Danny Marcus, a pleasure talking with you.
Pleasure talking to you, Genevieve.
Thank you. And if you'd like more information about this or any of the artists, musicians, or events you've heard about today, you can link to more at our website. That's at netnebraska.org/radio. An artist stages two large-scale projects in two small Nebraska towns. We'll learn more ahead here on Friday Live. Serving your community anywhere that might be, this is NET Radio and netnebraska.org. My next guest is many things, a consultant, a lawyer, a British expat, but most of all, he is curious, which is the word you'll see written across Stuart Chittenden's forehead in the photo on his website. Perhaps it's his curiosity that sparked a series of conversations across Nebraska and his project, A Couple of 830-Mile-Long Conversations. He's here to tell me if I'm right. Stuart Chittenden, it's great to meet you.
It's a pleasure to meet you, too. Thank you, Genevieve.
So what set you off in an RV across Nebraska to talk with residents of different communities?
It starts about 30 years ago. I read Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie as a teenager, and there was something in that archetypal idea of the American road and the pioneering spirit and traveling west that just caught my teenage imagination. And that, combined with a number of other pop culture references at the time from America, really just captivated my imagination. Now, of course, here we are 30 years on, and here I am married to a fine Nebraskan lady, and she brought me to Omaha, and I realized that I knew next to nothing about the state that I now call home. And increasingly, I'd sensed over the last few years that I wanted to know more about it. I wanted to know more about community. And I'd become convinced that conversation was a way to bridge divides and gain some understanding. So all of a sudden, it became clear to me that I had to put all of this to the test and scratch that itch that came to me some 30 years ago. And what's the expression? Head west, young man? And that's what I did.
Where did you grow up exactly?
I was born and raised in Canterbury in the southeast of England.
Now, you have a series of free events, tonight in Hastings at Prairie Loft at 5:30 and Sunday in Scotts Bluff at the Midwest Theater at 4:30. And you say that you'll share what you discovered about our state of Nebraska, its communities and its people, and yourself. What did you discover about yourself?
I had been planning this trip for several months, and I was ready to be on my own in an RV for 4 weeks out on the road meeting people. And when the moment came to actually drive away from my home, I felt an overwhelming sense of anxiety setting off and venturing away from what was familiar, from my wife, from my home, from what was the norm. it was a real eye-opener at how solitude and being alone can be such an anxiety-inducing experience. And it confirmed to me something really very important, which is that I believe every single one of us is yearning for connection with someone else and yearning to establish a relationship with other people. But it can be so intimidating to engage with other people, and so intimidating also to be on our own at the same time. And we're constantly navigating those two things, the fear of being alone and also the fear of approaching other people, which is partly why I think things like social media are so popular, because they fill that void. But I think of it a little bit as something like a carbohydrate. It's nourishing in the moment, but there's no long-term nutrition.
So when having these conversations in the communities across Nebraska, how do you think it changes things that you didn't grow up here, or does it change things?
It helps that not only was Nebraska and its people inherently strange to me, but I was obviously a stranger to the place and its people. And generally, I found that that meant that not only was I curious, but those people that I met that had curiosity were very willing to step towards me openly and engage with me. And that really did help. So instead of just being someone who looked slightly out of place, it was abundantly clear that I was a traveler, a guest in their community, and overwhelmingly people threw out the welcome mat in the acknowledgement of that. And my trip was certainly not comparable to De Tocqueville, but I think there's something to be said for someone who is clearly not from a place being welcomed. It stirs the hospitable nature in people. And if there's one thing that I think I discovered for myself, but I think people generally know about Nebraskans, is this is a group of hospitable people.
Were there some surprises?
There are always surprises. There were a variety of technical challenges with the RV, with some failed water heaters and sheared hinges. It wasn't the smoothest of rides. As regards to the landscape, I had been told to expect the sand hills to be remarkable, and they were. But what really stunned me were some of the waterways. Snake River Falls were astounding. Some of the state parks were really stunning and surprising in their beauty. And for me, being in the eastern part of the state, the landscape of the West is incredibly evocative, not only of how I imagine the West to be, but it is rich and tangible with the history of the state, that pioneering spirit, the indigenous peoples that are still there, but in a sort of different context. So that was surprising. I guess I wasn't expecting to be surprised by the hospitality of people, and I'm delighted to say that that was something that didn't surprise me. People were hospitable, and that was delightful.
I've been talking with Stuart Chittenden about his 830 Nebraska project, technically a couple of 830-mile-long conversations, in which he set off in an RV to have conversations in communities all across Nebraska. He'll be appearing tonight at Prairie Loft in Hastings at 5:30 p.m. to talk about his experiences, and again at the Midwest Theater in Scottsbluff on Sunday at 4:30. Stuart, thanks so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
And you can link to the 830 Nebraska website through the Friday Live page of our website. That's netnebraska.org/radio. Support for humanities-related programming on NET Radio comes from Humanities Nebraska, delivering opportunities to engage with history and culture. On the web at humanitiesnebraska.org. Be sure to check out the arts calendar on our website, both to make plans and to add your event. The address is netnebraska.org/radio. Just click events. Here are some highlights. The Museum of Nebraska Art in Kearney is hosting an exhibit of artwork by Nebraskans and those traveling through our state who have been inspired by the vast landscapes here. That exhibit is open at MONA through February 21st. Tomorrow night in Lincoln, flutist Leona Beinze will give a recital at UNL. She's performed all over the world, including as principal flutist with the Boston Symphony and Boston Pops. Her performance will be in Westbrook Recital Hall on the UNL campus tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. and is free and open to the public. And a history of the U.S. flag, our national anthem, and the War of 1812 will be presented in Alliance at the Public Library on Thursday at 6:30 p.m. For more information about these and other events, visit our website, netnebraska.org/radio. If you've ever become so attached to a character in a novel that you weren't ready to say goodbye at the end, then we've got just the book for you. All About Books host Pat Leach talks with Kirsten Hill about The Collector's Society by Heather Lyons.
Have you ever finished a book and then you ponder what happens to those characters after the story ends?
Mm-hmm.
How do their stories continue? I know that I have thought that, and I think that most fanatical readers have as well. And The Collector's Society is really a book lover's dream. It's a book where beloved book characters have evolved outside of their stories, and they morph into something more. It takes some of my literary favorites and turns them into three-dimensional characters and takes what we know of these characters and translates them to the world that we live in.
Hear a full review of The Collector's Society, learn about book blogs, the world of independent publishing, and try to figure out how to quit your job so you can read more. Go to the All About Books page of our website, netnebraska.org/radio. There are two public art projects opening in Northeast Nebraska, both part of the Byway of Art project from Art Place America. One will open November 1st, that's Sunday, in Decatur, called Rural Legends. The other is Monday in Lyons, Nebraska, called Storefront Theater. Matthew Mazzotta is an artist who has worked all over the globe, Saudi Arabia, Singapore, New York, and now Nebraska. And he joins me to tell us about these two unique installations, I guess I would say. It's great to meet you, Matthew.
Yeah, nice to meet you, too.
So you call some of these pieces that you do public interventions.
That's a bit of an art term, but basically what it is artwork that's in the public space in people's towns and cities, available to anybody who wants to come, so open to the public and always for free. My particular projects are community-specific, so they're actually born out of conversations I have with people to really get to an issue that's just under the surface. And then we build a project that basically is in relationship to that, and it's all about giving time and space to look at their town in a new way. A lot of it is social, so people actually get to see other people in their community, you know, either do something or experience something together. In these projects, we'll talk about it. There might even be storytelling.
There's an actual legend associated with this project, which you're calling Rural Legends. And that legend has something to do with a photo of a trolley in this town of less than 500 people. Can you tell us about that?
I'm interested in going to an area that I've never been before, a stranger, trying to unearth something. We do an outdoor living room or a living room on Main Street event. Take a whole bunch of living room furniture, put it on Main Street, make it look like a living room, and invite people in. So this is a strange meeting, not like in the city hall. So I asked some questions. An indicator, one question that really resonated was, what's a rare history of Decatur? And people spoke about, in this little town of 450 people, the Dry Land Bridge, a bridge that was built before a river was routed through it, or Jesse James's mother taught high school there, and a pizza joint and roller skating rink. But one thing they mentioned was they used to have a trolley. And as soon as I heard that, I said, "You sure?" And the guy says, "Yeah, we definitely had a trolley, and there's a photo in the restaurant." And the restaurant owner says, "There's no photo in my restaurant, but I do remember seeing that photo." So for 6 hours, we heard this trolley story along with all the other stories. And at the very end of this little living room event, a woman sat down, and I go, so what are some rare histories of Decatur? And she started rattling off Jesse James' mother, you know, the dry land bridge, all the ones I knew. And I said, and a trolley. And she looked at me, and she said, there's never a trolley in Decatur. And I said, yeah, well, all these people think there's a trolley. And she said, there was never a trolley in Decatur, but there was a postcard made back in the day to market our town as a bigger town to draw people in. So we located this photo, and that became the premise of the whole project about legends. So we actually brought a real trolley now into Decatur, and it's got a station, and it's now a storytelling place. So we opened it all up. We took out the steering wheel and the driver's seat, put a bench there. Now it's going to be for three people telling about one legend once a month in Decatur.
Then we should talk about the event in Lyons as well on Monday, the Storefront Theater, which will also feature music and an actual film, since the word theater is in there.
We went to Lyons, a town about 850, put the living room out there, and I started asking questions. People said our downtown core is something that used to be very vibrant with social life and commerce. They said it's so sad to see all those good bones just sit there, and there's mostly storage inside. So they were very interested in this downtown core being activated. During this conversation, someone else mentioned, when I said, what's an underutilized resource of Lyons? Someone said, hey, that building right there, that storefront, has no building behind it. It's just a facade. So actually that became the site. And so what we did is we took part of the facade on Main Street, put some hydraulic pumps and a metal door on it and a metal awning in such a way that it folds down over the sidewalk, bleachers pull out, and on the other side of the street is a movie screen. So it makes downtown Lyons into a storefront theater. First thing we're going to do is Josephine Foster, who's acclaimed musician, she's coming and she's going to do a small set. And then we found a local guy. We commissioned him to do a film called Decades, all about the downtown. So he's doing it over the years. And this really kind of beautiful thing happened when he started doing these recreations over the different decades. Like one of them was Saturday Night, 1960s. All these people donated their vintage cars and dressed up as 1960s. And we actually recreated the downtown with all these different kind of things. So it looked like 1960s Lyons, Nebraska. But his film will be about 40 minutes, and he'll play that right after Josephine does her music.
What do you hope the long-term outcome will be of these projects?
Indicator, I think the greatest thing that could happen is that voices that usually don't get heard will come to the table, because if they're telling legends, you can't be wrong. People will come and share their stories. And just like we unearthed the fact that this trolley was a legend, maybe some other things get unearthed, and people can start to see Decatur in a different light because more voices will come through. So I think that could grow in a very charming way. For the Storefront Theater, to me, it's almost a call to arms. It's saying people have this desire to be in the downtown. They remember these times, however, it doesn't exist anymore. And we're saying, can these bones be reprogrammed through creativity to have another kind of social experience? I'm hoping that when people are in the downtown watching a film about the downtown, they'll be able to look out with these kind of more in tune eyes and say, hey, you know, we really should do something besides just let these things fall apart, because it's almost like a sculpture in the middle of their town if you think about it. That would be the greatest thing if people actually took this as a catalyst to say, hey, we need to be more involved in each other's lives, or maybe we can transform this together.
I've been talking with artist Matthew Mazzotta about two projects opening in Decatur and Lyons, Nebraska. Both are part of the Byway of Art project. Rural Legends is from 3 to 5 p.m. on Sunday in Decatur. And on Monday in Lyons, Storefront Theater opens from 6 to 8 p.m.
I think we're going to actually open up the door at 6:30, and then we'll start with the thing.
Matthew, really a pleasure talking with you.
Of course, Genevieve.
And you can link to more information through our website. That's netnebraska.org/radio. Just click on the icon for Friday Live. Artwork in Alliance and the Nebraska Arts Council Governor's Arts Award still to talk about yet this morning here on Friday Live on NET Radio. We're coming to you from the Mill in the historic Haymarket District here in Lincoln. I'm Genevieve Randall. Next, the latest theater production at Nebraska Wesleyan University, the Tony Award-winning musical Thoroughly Modern Millie, will run tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m., as well as again next weekend. I'm joined by Julie Heaton, assistant professor of theater and director of the show, as well as Brooke Bosworth, who is a junior from Olathe, Kansas, and plays Millie. Welcome to Friday Live.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The setting for Thoroughly Modern Millie is 1922. So what kinds of things do we see in the set and costuming that put us right there in the roaring 20s?
Well, you're going to see a lot of drop-waisted dresses, a lot of little skinny ties, bow ties on the men, and a lot of fun costumes that you get to wear.
Yeah, I have approximately 8 costumes the entire show. We have an amazing costume designer, Rebecca Armstrong. She helped make almost every costume, like every single one. She helped hand sew, and our costume shop also helped out sewing everything. It was a lot of work, but it paid off. Yeah. It's so much fun to wear them.
Fun, yeah.
So, Brooke, what is motivating your character? She's a rural girl who moves to New York City. What are her hopes?
Well, Millie moves to New York to... She wants to marry a rich guy. She wants to have the fancy lifestyle of all the jewels, all the fancy dresses. She just wants a good life, and she didn't have that, obviously, in Kansas, because she moves, and she finds out that her outfit just doesn't fit in. So she gets, like, a huge haircut, she changes her style, and then she's on the hunt for the perfect man who's going to be able to provide everything that she needs. But she's really spunky, and so she's got, like, this fire that even though she wants a man to provide for her, she's willing to do her own work and put in some stuff. So that's her motivation, is to get the perfect guy.
I think it's interesting that she's from Kansas and you're from Kansas.
I know, isn't that ironic? And it's weird that I actually have been to Salina, Kansas, which is where Millie is from. Like, I never planned to go to Salina, Kansas, but just a friend of mine had a grandparents there, and she's like, come visit. And I was like, okay, who knew? Yeah. Later, I'd be playing someone from Salina, Kansas.
Do you feel that there's any sort of stereotyping of Kansas going on, or do you think it's more of kind of this universal thing that some people go through where they just want that rich and famous thing in their life?
I think it's a universal thing that... Like, if you're from a small town, you just want something more, something bigger. But, you know, there's always those Kansas stereotypes of small town, I'm so nice, I'm a Midwestern, I say hello to everyone, I have excitement. But that's Nebraska, too, so just Midwest in general.
The 1967 movie version of this really had this star-studded cast with Julie Andrews and Mary Tyler Moore. I'm wondering what you enjoy most about getting to play this character.
Oh, man. I think she's so exciting. It's so exciting to have so much energy in such a show and be able to be just, like, this wide-eyed, everything's going to work out. I'm just kind of having this excitement for the future. That's so much fun. And it's, like, there's so much, like, liberty in the character. So you're on stage and she might react different at a different night. But it's always exciting.
Some pretty big singing that you get to do also, which is pretty fun.
Oh, yeah. That's also very fun. And yeah. Julie Heaton she's been great. She taught me a new way to sing, which has been absolutely phenomenal with this role, which has helped so much.
So what was the change?
Just putting my belt in a different place. And things just, like, kind of clicked. And then it helped Millie click even more. So hooray for Julie.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, it's nice when you have students that have an opportunity to really grow in a role, and it's not, you know, getting into a role and actually doing the whole show is different than coming up to, you know, musical theater class and just picking one song out of the whole show. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's a matter of endurance and finding a way that you're going to be able to go the whole 2.5 hours and make it all work. And then sometimes it's just a matter of stylistic choice. And Brooke was really close. I mean, we kind of have a philosophy over at Wesleyan is if you cast the show well, your job is so much easier. So she was right there, you know. We just made a couple little modifications, and she's really grown into the role, and it's been a great opportunity for her. I think she's grown as an actress as a result of this, so it's been great.
What's unique about your particular production of this show?
I'd say the costumes, definitely. Yeah. Because most of them are built from, you know, in our costume shop, so that's going to be very unique. We have a fun set.
Yeah.
And you know, really great set designer that we have some pretty cool tools in our scene shop, a saw in particular, that you can put a pattern into and kind of customize, handcraft these pieces. So there's a lot of decorative wood pieces mm-hmm. on the set that are very, very unique just to us because of the equipment that we have. So
I've been talking with Julie Heaton and Brooke Bosworth. Brooke Bosworth plays Millie in the show, Thoroughly Modern Millie. Julie Heaton is director as well as assistant professor of theater at Nebraska Wesleyan University. Their production of Thoroughly Modern Millie opened last night and continues tonight, tomorrow, Sunday, and next weekend at the McDonald Theater on the Nebraska Wesleyan campus. It's a pleasure having you here this morning.
It was awesome
to be
here.
Thanks for having us.
The annual Nebraska Arts Council Governors Arts Awards, that's ahead, and they are still taking submissions for nominees. We'll talk more about that here on NET Radio's Friday Live. The Scala and Garwood Galleries at the Carnegie Arts Center and Alliance will exhibit work by Mary Zickafoos of Omaha and Steve Mawson of Lincoln, November 3rd through January 2nd. Steve Mawson primarily works with wood, and he joins me to tell us more about his work. Steve, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
You are a member of something called the Great Plains Wood Turning Club of Lincoln, I discovered by looking online. So, for listeners who aren't woodworkers, what does it mean to turn wood?
Well, you actually start out with any kind of a piece of wood, usually hardwoods because they work best, and put it on something called a wood lathe. And a wood lathe is nothing more than a motor on one end and a way to anchor the wood in between two centers, and you turn it round.
So what are some examples of pieces that you create? What kinds of things can you do by turning wood?
Bowls are probably the most common. Well, the equipment has changed quite a bit in the last 20 or 30 years. Spindle turning was common a long time ago mm-hmm. because stairways had balusters on them that were all spindle turned. You can make wooden utensils by spindle turning. You can make spoons and ladles and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of way it got started. And then with the change in equipment, you can hold pieces of wood on a lathe. You hold it on one end and you can use your tools and go into it from the other end. So you can make bowls, you can make hollow forms or vases. A vase is basically a hollow form, so that's kind of some of the stuff that I do. Indian art stuff started a little later, and that you start out on the lathe and make the basket or the platter, the plate, and then you decorate it after that.
How did you first get started working with wood?
I had an uncle that was a wood turner many, many years ago, and he had an old Craftsman wood lathe up in his, called the wash house, which had a bottom floor and upstairs, and his woodworking stuff went on in the upstairs, and the downstairs was used for washing, actually. So he was a woodworker, and he kind of got me started, got me interested, and then I kind of ebbed and flowed from that for quite a few years. But then when I joined the Great Plains Wood Turners in Lincoln here in 2008, I got a little more serious as far as trying to learn to be better and make stuff a little more exotic, and kind of go from there.
I wonder what some of the challenges are to creating those turned pieces. And you mentioned earlier types of wood that you like to work with. Does one type or another make it more difficult?
Usually not. Pine is difficult to work with just because it's a soft wood, got a lot of pitch in it that gums up things. Most of your hardwoods really work well, cherry, oak, walnut, and then some of your southwest woods like mesquite, eucalyptus. Some of those kind of woods are very unique because you don't find them in the Midwest. and then you can make some really pretty things out of them. And then there's some wood form called burls.
Hmm.
Burls don't really have grain in them, but they're very unique looking in the way they look. And they're kind of hard to come by just because they don't grow everywhere. So you can really make some fantastic pieces out of those things when you can find them.
Steve Mawson's turned pieces will be on display at the Carnegie Arts Center in Alliance. And again, that's November 3rd through January 2nd. Steve, thanks so much for telling us about your work.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
This is Friday Live. I'm Genevieve Randall. We'll hear about a reimagining of King Lear at the Blue Barn Theater in Omaha coming up here on Friday Live. Next, from the Nebraska Arts Council, I'm joined by Suzanne Wise to talk about their biennial awards event this year, with awards being presented by Governor Pete Ricketts, or I should say next year, I guess, is when they'll be presenting those awards. The deadline for the nominations is November 6th. Suzanne, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing good, actually, on this chillier morning than usual.
I know, but it's supposed to get warm this weekend.
That's good.
Isn't that weird that we're talking about it getting warm?
I know,
and it'll be October. November.
Yeah,
I don't
right.
believe it.
So in order to nominate someone for the Governor's Arts Award, there's a form online, but there are some required pieces of information. So what is the process?
Well, the process is to go to our website and look at the form so you know what it is you're going to have to put together. And there needs to be some letters of support and some information about who you're nominating. And we highly recommend that you click on the list of previous award winners, because we often get people that will come up with a name and we'll say, yeah, they are great, and they got an award in 2012.
Right.
So check that out first.
So are the categories the same from time to time?
The categories are the same. We have six of them. And actually, we have a newer category that we started, I think, it's been now 4 years ago, called Emerging Leaders. I think there's a recognition that the arts community has a lot of young, exciting talent, and we'd really like to recognize that. And by young, it can be someone in their 30s, and maybe even a little bit older than that if they're new to their work, they're new to what they're doing.
What's the history of the awards, and are there Governor's Arts Awards in other states?
A lot of states have Governor's Arts Awards. Our Governor's Arts Awards dates back to 1978, and it used to be an annual event, but when you only have a staff of 10 people and we have to do all of the work and we are not professional party planners, it takes us a while to gear up. So it was changed to every other year, sometime in the early 90s, I believe.
So when I look at the list of past awards, it really is statewide. Chadron, Kearney, Scotts Bluff, Marquette, Norfolk, Wahoo. What do you think is the importance or outcome, I guess, of this recognition for our communities all across the state?
Well, I think you just said it. Arts happen across this state. And I think there may be a preconceived idea that, well, because Omaha and Lincoln are just packed with arts organizations and a lot of artists live in those communities, that they have a natural leg up on the Governor's Arts Awards, and that's not true at all. And so this is a wonderful way to showcase what's going on in the rest of the state.
I've been talking here with Suzanne Wise, who is Executive Director of the Nebraska Arts Council, and they've extended their deadline for nominations for the Governor's Arts Awards for 2016, and that deadline is in around a week, right? November 6th?
November 6th, correct.
So get those nominations in. Suzanne, thanks so much for being here this morning.
Thank you.
Just in time for All Hallows' Eve, audiences in Omaha are invited to a reimagining of Shakespeare's King Lear. Ben Rasmussen of KVNO has more about Spencer Williams' Walk the Night.
In collaboration with the Blue Barn Theater, Walk the Night is presenting its second annual production in the Omaha area titled Where Madness Lies. Creator Spencer Williams says this year's show is a staging of Shakespeare's tragedy, King Lear, a heartrending story of love, loyalty, and betrayal.
King Lear has three daughters, the two of which are secretly plotting against both one another and King Lear at the same time, and a third daughter who is true to her word and true to her father.
However, Walk the Night is not a traditional theater experience. For starters, Lear is not even a king, but might be a queen.
Our Lear is to be played by Moira Mangimelli, a local powerhouse and brilliant actor. I'm so pleased and delighted to have on board. But Moira obviously is a woman. So already we're starting with something of a spin, something of a twist.
Williams points out that other aspects of the play and even the concept of theater are revamped and reimagined in Walk the Night.
The way that our story plays out is in real time, without seats, without a backstage, without any conventional boundaries between an audience and the performance itself. We have 15 stories essentially all taking place at the same time in an alternate location that has multiple levels, multiple rooms. So it allows for a choose-your-own-adventure version of King Lear. The events happen regularly. You know, you can follow King Lear and get the story of King Lear, but you also have 14 other stories that you can follow at your will and go and look at as you so choose.
Key to the realization of this experience is the location. This year, Walk the Night will present in the century-old Starlight Chateau on North 29th Street in Omaha, which formerly housed a religious order and currently hosts weddings and other special occasions. With a production so completely different from the norm, it should come as no surprise that even the audience has a role to play.
The audience will come as initiates into a society, into a secret culture. The members of this culture are in communion with spirits. The idea is that those audience members who engage in the culture will attain access to it, will achieve a connection that others may not.
In fact, the play will be staged not once, but twice nightly, with a discount for those who stay for both shows in the same evening. This allows audience members to take a different path through the action, to choose their own adventure and experience King Lear from a completely different angle. Walk the Night, Where Madness Lies runs through November 21st at the Starlight Chateau at 1310 North 29th Street in Omaha. Tickets and more information are available at www.walkthenightwithme.com. For Friday Live, I'm Ben Rasmussen.
Coming up on NET Radio, classical music on Morning Concert, and this afternoon, Laura Black and Classics by Request. Be sure to visit our website for podcasts of the show, netnebraska.org/radio. Thanks to everyone who makes Friday Live possible, including Fuse Co-working for providing our Wi-Fi hookup, James DeShano, and associate producer Dave Hughes. I'm Genevieve Randall.
Support for programming on NET Radio comes from the Sheldon Museum of Art, presenting Art and Social Justice Week through today. Events are open to the public. A full schedule is available at sheldonartmuseum.org. Hangers Cleaners, with six locations in Lincoln, 21st and G, 70th and Van Dorn, Rathbone Village, 27th and Pine Lake, Connington and A, and 8th and P Streets. And the Burkholder Project, promoting local artists' works for 28 years. Artists in residence with Open Door Studios at 719 P Street in Lincoln's historic Haymarket, and on the web at burkholderproject.com.